I do believe if you just keep doing the right thing, then good things will happen. They will definitely be bumpy. Being a bit of a disruptor, I think, can be a little bit bumpy, but I think it's a lot easier to sleep at night knowing you did the right thing by everybody, not just the right thing by yourself. People who are in more senior positions, they need to get out of their comfort zone so that other people can get into their comfort zone. And that will allow things to change quicker, because as soon as you get all of the people who currently aren't able to be themselves coming out and being themselves, whatever that may look like, what they wear, how they feel, using parts of their brain they hadn't been able to necessarily feel comfortable using before, that will speed up the change. That will make people feel more included.
Lieutenant Tony Harding is an air engineering officer in the Royal Navy, a STEM ambassador, and she also works with the Armed Forces rugby team. In a very short time, Tony has already packed in a lot. Currently committed to serving on one of the aircraft carriers, Tony came ashore to share her insights about leading well. Tony is a self-confessed disruptor who recognizes this can create waves, but she strongly believes that good things happen when you do the right thing. There is so much in this episode that's worth hearing. Zone out all the distractions and immerse yourself in the energy. And be prepared for the unexpected. Leopard print heels on the rugby pitch? I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Tony.
My parents couldn't necessarily afford to send me to university. My uncle had been an air engineer back in the day in the Navy and suggested that I had a look at the sponsorship scheme. I did. It was really good. 3 years as a reserve at university and then straight into Dartmouth. So guaranteed job, really. And I've been in since.
You said your uncle was in the Navy as well. Did that take you to a particular part of the Navy?
I think so. I think I always loved science, so kind of STEM subjects. So it seemed a no-brainer to become an engineer fixing problems. Thankfully, I don't actually physically fix helicopters. I think all the guys and girls that I've worked with would say it's a good job that I don't get to touch them. I think what appealed as a 17, 18-year-old was being able to go into a different environment and also being able to serve your country. I do think culturally there's, in this country, there's fewer people who feel inclined to need to serve. So yeah, joined up, served the country, served Queen at the time, now King, and try and give a little bit back, I think, to the country that I've been quite fortunate to be brought up in and challenge myself whilst travelling. And I've done all those things. Been quite lucky, really, that I managed to pack so much in.
And you've just finished, I think, an amazing job, which has the almost the best title of all, which is Flag Lieutenant to the Second Sea Lord.
Yeah, it's got a good title. I don't think I'm ever going to beat that. So I worked for Vice Admiral Martin Connell as his Flag Lieutenant, which those of us in the Army, Navy, RAF who've done that will describe it as a bag-carrying role. To a degree, is that. However, depending on the senior officer that you're fortunate enough to work for slash with, you can do so much more than that. So it's your exposure as a very junior officer, as a lieutenant or a captain or flight lieutenant, to experience what actually happens in wider defence. And it's definitely completely changed how I see things, think about things. I can understand a little bit more about how people think on a strategic level, which, going back to the fleet, has been fantastic. But yeah, it's a great job.
You talked about bag carriers, which is a slightly pejorative term, but it has an inference that you're a yes person and that you do the bidding of your boss. My sense is that that isn't always the case for you.
I think you're right. That's such an interesting thing to know. I definitely can be a yes person. I'm definitely a yes person when it comes to getting stuff done. Mm. But I can also be a no slash a why person. I think in those kind of roles, you definitely are there to protect your principal. So you can't just be a yes person, because if you did, they wouldn't be protected. They haven't got eyes and ears absolutely everywhere. That's part of your job as well, not just carrying their luggage. Although I must admit, Admiral Martin quite enjoyed carrying his own luggage. So that was good. I definitely would put myself more in the disruptor camp, which I'm okay with. I haven't always been okay with that. When I was sub-lieutenant going through training, I had a division officer at the time who I raised something to, and he said, you need to formally raise this. And I did not feel comfortable formally raising it at the time. In hindsight, I now preach to a lot of the people that I work with and say, you need to formally raise it. Either I can do it, or there's ways of doing it, because that division officer at the time said, if you don't raise it, this is going to happen to someone else. At the time, I kind of tried to forget about that and kind of tried to ignore that little feeling of guilt because I was so worried about what that might do to me in my career or how that might affect the relationships that I had with the class or that individual. But now I feel I'm able to kind of put those to one side. I do believe if you just keep doing the right thing, then good things will happen. They will definitely be bumpy. Being a bit of a disruptor, I think, can be a little bit bumpy, but I think it's a lot easier to sleep at night knowing you did the right thing by everybody, not just the right thing by yourself.
In some ways, you were very lucky to have that divisional officer who said you what you ought to do, mm-hmm. but the challenge is knowing how to do it, particularly yeah. if you don't feel like you are part of the organisation or you don't have the power or the ability to make that change. Mm-hmm. You came to becoming a disruptor partly, presumably, because you saw things that you thought needed disrupting or changing. Do you remember what it was that made you feel that now was the time to become a disruptor? Was it like that? Was it evolutionary?
So I think going back to when my first deployment as still a baby sub-lieutenant, I just passed my charge board, less than 2 years from commissioning, and COVID hit, and I was on a Merlin frontline squadron on 845, which is Commander Helicopter Force, as newly kind of charge qualified air engineering officer. And we got an R2 shout, so the first Merlin R2 shout for Mark IV. R2 means you could be at 5 days' notice to go anywhere. So the balloon goes up, and in 5 days, they want you to be on task or heading on task. The UK had just gone into lockdown, I think it was the day before. We got the activation order on a Thursday, and then on the Sunday we embarked onto the RFA Argus and sailed down to the Caribbean in support of the overseas territories down there. Element of humanitarian aid, but also just in case COVID did kind of kick off down there, we were there showing force and supporting. We had no idea what we were going to be doing. The activation order kind of just said, just go down and be ready. A captain called Phil Dennis, who's now one star, we got brought into the hangar on Argus and he was like, I'm going to give everyone a bit of a chat. And I thought, here we go. We're going to get another senior officer that's going to tell us how great it's going to be. And he didn't. He just said, this is going to be pretty rubbish. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, who's this guy? And I had a team of about 40-something engineers, many of whom had never been to sea before, many of whom's concerns were, I'm not going to have a mobile phone, which at the time I remember thinking, how bizarre, but actually now I really understand that. And we didn't know what we were going to do. And there's this guy who's got a load of gold on his shoulder who's supposed to be in charge, and he's just said he doesn't really know either, and it's going to be a bit rubbish. And it was the best thing he could have said, because he also said, if you need to push the boundaries, I will support you. If you feel like you're not getting what you need, I will back you. Come and tell me, let's work through it, and I'll back you. And that was amazing. And he's still really good to this day. And I reflected on it recently with him, actually, in the garden near work, and just said how important it was that he said those pretty blasé, brash kind of words, but really set the tone and kind of managed expectations. So on that deployment, there were a couple of issues we had. A lot of people, I think, would have said, the book says X. And when it comes to aviation, the book's really clear because people's lives are at stake if you don't get it right. And I got to make some pretty interesting decisions and test some interesting technologies that were not cleared. We risk assessed it. We pushed it back to the UK. We got the kind of go ahead and we got to try things that we normally wouldn't have. And as you know, on operations, you get that kind of luxury. You're afforded that ability to make things work because you need to. That was when I definitely first started doing it. And that was really cool. As a 25-year-old, that was really cool.
How remarkable to have that opportunity so early on and to recognise the impact that Captain Dennis had at the time. Mm. Presumably you've then role-played that, you've seen that role modelling and you've then used that yourself. When you came back from that operation and into the what often is called the bureaucracy of working in a big headquarters, did that generate some of the frustration that you saw, well, we've tested and tried it and pushed the boundaries on operations, why aren't we doing it so much here?
Yeah, I think so. I do get very frustrated about things because when you're fighting the good fight, even if it's not a fight, but you're on operations, you get afforded that luxury. Then you come back and actually, if we don't challenge the bureaucracy here, things won't be ready and working for the people that need them on operations. And that is frustrating, but it's understanding how you can manage that. I definitely have people that I can vent to, but I also try and see it from everyone's perspective a little bit more. Worked for 2 years with the civil service, which was amazing. So I think, again, I'd recommend that anyone in uniform tries and works in a civil service environment whenever they can, because you need to understand how difficult it is sometimes to get a business case through. It's not as simple as writing a note to a 3-star and getting impressing go. It's really not. There's a lot more at stake. Putting myself into a defence equipment support job, mainly in the civil service, after operations was great because all the stuff that I was frustrated about, I got to go and understand why I was frustrated about it and then tweak a couple of things and try and fix them, even if they took longer than anticipated.
You come across as being someone who has enormous energy and huge positivity, but there's also a steeliness about you that one detects. Do you think that's helped you in unlocking some of the obstacles or not?
I think so. I think it depends, really. I don't think I've always been as kind of robust as I am now. But I think that goes for most of us, right? Because of the lessons that we learn. And I reflected quite a lot when I listened to Rosie talking. Rosie Ward on her recent podcast. She could have given up at any point, but she still has this energy. You know, after everything she's been through, and while she said she wasn't a trailblazer, she's very much a trailblazer to me. Rosie, you are a trailblazer in my mind. And I try and reflect all the time, and I try to be as self-aware as I can be. I can always do better at that. I think we all can. But I've realised that being positive sometimes can just rule over everything else. There's a lieutenant who I work with who is just so positive. He has just got this energy that I am so envious of. I say it here, we definitely won't say it to his face tomorrow when I go out to work. So envious of it because he just like shines and radiates his positive stuff and it tumbles around that energy, picks everyone up. It's kind of like a massive snowball, picks everyone up. And I think you have to be like that. Being positive is important.
My daughters are going to be really unhappy with, because I'm going to use a quote that I often use, which is a great quote around positive energy. And it is that those that bring the sunshine to the lives of others cannot keep it from themselves. And I think that whilst that is true, what do you do to recharge your batteries?
So I definitely think I'm much more aware now of when my batteries need recharging. For example, this week, just took myself away for 5 days. I just went away, did something different, walked through a park, listened to my... I've got a very clear playlist that I will listen to when I need that motivation. I'll ring certain people. So I know there's certain people that will tell me what I don't want to hear, which is good. And also what I do want to hear sometimes, which is also good. So having a huge network for me helps me recharge quite a lot. I get quite a lot of energy from people around me, whether they're work, friends, colleagues, family. I used to have, in my last job, I used to take one Sunday a week where I would not set an alarm, not have a coffee, and just really do nothing, like not even really turn my phone on, just wander around endlessly around the gardens where I live and kind of almost write it off as a day, if that makes sense. And that would then recharge me for like another week or two, which is good.
And I know that you've done some mentoring. I mean, you're talking in a way that I'm learning lots that I wished I'd learned years ago. You've done some mentoring work as well. Why are you doing that?
So it's kind of a bit selfish because I actually get loads from mentoring myself, if that makes sense. So I learn so much. I just love learning from people, particularly those that are different to me, have had different backgrounds, upbringings, you know, not engineers, not in science. When I was a junior officer, I had really good mentors and I still do have some really good mentors, people who've offered their time. And they have made me think really differently. And they've also are really happy to point out my weaknesses and to say, you probably need to stop doing this because this doesn't help you in this. They're the people that will say, go recharge your batteries. Stop, recharge. Because I'm not the kind of person that will instantly always do that myself. So I need someone to kind of go, you're not you and you're hungry kind of thing, you know. But giving something back, because you just don't know what you don't know in life in general, let alone in work. Surrounding yourself with people that you can just ring up and talk to. There is a captain that has mentored me since she was a commander. I've saved all her post-it notes, actually. Rosie Ward reminded me of it when she said that she'd ripped off the piece of her kind of calendar. And I've saved all those post-it notes. And every now and then I just open my box and read through the post-it notes and just remind myself of those things. Mentoring's important, I think, for everyone.
In your work, you're not just doing your day job. I think you have other work that's a big commitment too.
Yeah, so alongside some of the little mentoring things, I try to do as much STEM ambassador work as I can as well. So whether that's going into schools and chatting about my career, there's an element of you can't be what you can't see, if that makes sense. So talking to people about my career, and I feel like that's kind of time bound because I was really effective of that when I was 23, 24, whereas I'm always 30 now and I don't feel I relate as easily to A-level students. But I also do quite a lot of media work with UK Armed Forces Rugby. a year ago, I'd never touched a rugby ball. And the Navy's director of rugby, who's a good friend of mine, Tom Blackburn, rang me up and said, we need some help. We just need more people to do media. But it also tells the story of sport in the armed forces, which is a huge part of being in the armed forces. So I get to do that, spread the word of rugby, which again, still not really sure what's going on every time I watch it on the field. But I've also been able to meet people from every service, all backgrounds, professionals, you know, elite athletes, down to people that never thought they'd be able to represent the UK Armed Forces, which is great.
And for someone who's not been immersed in the world of rugby, what have been the surprises?
Yeah, unsurprisingly, there has been a lot of surprises. I used to horse ride a little bit, and that sometimes can be quite cliquey. But I think rugby is kind of on a different level, I think. Now, I think a lot of people have grown up playing rugby from day one. Pretty much their entire military career has focused around rugby, which for a lot of people is kind of a dream, right? You're a professional athlete because you're getting paid to go to work every day. Your work is a rugby field or a gym. Culturally, I think I struggled with certain aspects of feeling, again, not part of the club, if that makes sense. It wasn't like being an air engineering officer where you build up your experience and you have that reputation. I didn't have that rapport because what does this random woman know about rugby who's got her leopard print heels on a training pitch? Like, what's she doing with her iPad? But there was a gap in the kind of UCAF rugby market for a media person, and I tried to fill it. There have definitely been some times, especially in the past year, where it has been difficult culturally. Again, coming in as someone who's a little bit different to an organisation where it's their club, right? It's their club. It's this club that's been going for a long time. And a lot of the people in this club are paid very well to be in that club. So someone who's not been paid to be in the club and has just stumbled upon it, what can you bring? Why are they here? And I definitely struggled in some aspects with some of the kind of cultures and behaviours that I saw in a couple of the tours matches that we played. Luckily, because of my ability to disrupt, I wasn't going to just stand there and let it happen because I felt like it was actually hurting our own performance as a unit and as a team. And I stood up and said something, which I was really well supported with. And I realised that I probably could have said something sooner, or someone else could have said something sooner, if the individuals in that organisation had known. It hadn't really been a problem when they were all together, because why would it be? But when you insert this crazy odd woman with leopard print heels, it needed to change. You need to address these things together rather than move on or don't say anything or, you know, write to the Daily Mail. I feel like not everyone can have these conversations, but I was able to stand up and have that conversation. And a couple of the girls who were mainly physios, who were a lot younger than me, said, I would never have been able to do that. But I also feel like I probably could now because I saw you do it, as crazy as it looked and as crazy as it was. Yeah, things have completely changed. I've seen men now in my organisation actively call it out in front of all sorts of people, senior officers, each other, which is really important. It's been an interesting journey and I've learnt loads.
What a brilliant example of how you can change culture with one action. But going to that one action that you took, the sense I got from what you said is that you found that difficult and that you perhaps couldn't have done it if you were earlier on in your career. What do you think provided you the armour or the strength to do that?
I think going back to that divisional officer in my earlier career who said, if you don't stand up for a minority, for other women, for example, who's going to do it? And then someone else could face that issue. So I think it was as simple as that, really. Yeah, it was a really scary time. I remember the weeks leading up to it, I was thinking about it. And one of the team managers at the time said, do you want me to do it? And I was like, no, that sounds great, but no, it needs to come from me. And it was really scary standing in front of people that I really respected because of the sport they play. The attitude and courage that they go about their sport with is inspiring. There was just a little niggle and I kind of needed to get it off my chest. I got it off my chest. We've all kind of had really interesting conversations since about that. And that's the thing, is there were some conversations that were generated because I hadn't felt I could say it to individuals. By the time I said it to people as a collective, we have great conversations now. And people come and speak to me and say, oh, I saw this at work. What do you think I should do? I'm like, oh, I'm really glad that you feel you can ask me that.
Well, I'm really interested. I remember someone saying to me that you can't get someone from the out culture to change the in culture. That's clearly not the case. And someone offered to do it on your behalf, who I presume was from the in culture. But you were adamant that you had to do that. Why is that the case, that you think it should have come from someone who wasn't part of the culture?
I think it just has a bit more gravity. That person who was in the in culture was kind of on the fence. You could tell he was kind of, he knew that the in culture wasn't right, but it almost took a trigger, me being a trigger really, just to actually talk about it and change something. It needed to come from me because I was the one that experienced it. There's two sides here. It's sometimes easy to say, you know, I'm a man, this is not great, crack on, but you've not necessarily got the experience. But there's also an element of, it's important that we have allies, particularly male allies. And I think now that out culture needs to seep into the in culture. It doesn't, it's not like a hard rule where it needs to change everything instantly. The signs of it changing are the individuals that have come to me and said, oh, this happened, or actually I won't post that because that's not right. Yeah, I definitely think out culture can change in culture. It just takes a while.
And you've talked about change. In the time that you've started serving, you've seen change. There is some criticism about the pace and the rate of change. Do you think that we can accelerate the rate of change, or do you think that it's going to go at a pace that's set by the institution?
I don't know, really. I'm excited to find out. I hope it's quicker than it's ever been, if that makes sense. But I do think we do need to pause a little bit and just recognise the journey we've been on. And again, I don't know if this is because I'm more part of the furniture now. It's really hard to tell, isn't it? I think it just takes people who are in more senior positions, they need to get out of their comfort zone so that other people can get into their comfort zone. And that will allow things to change quicker. Because as soon as you get all of the people who currently aren't able to be themselves coming out and being themselves, whatever that may look like, what they wear, how they feel, using parts of their brain they hadn't been able to necessarily feel comfortable using before, that will speed up the change. That will make people feel more included. I genuinely believe that will hurry programmes along, and we will probably spend less money because we'll be more efficient. So I think the quicker we can make this organisation more and more inclusive, the quicker that change will be.
You were saying you're too old to do work with A-level graduates about career choices. But what's your motivation to do that work with the A-level students?
I found an interesting statistic actually last week, which said in 2019, I think 49% of people that started Sandhurst had a private education. There's no issue with that. The important thing I think to recognise is that we have a pool of people, 93% of which we're maybe not tapping into. I was definitely one of those 93%. I really valued the state education I had. My education would definitely have been a lot better had I been afforded the opportunity to go to private school. So for me, whilst some of the mentoring I do is focused on minority groups, tends to be focused on minority groups you can see. Mm-hmm. So it's really easy to walk into a room and say, oh, you're a woman, you're black, you're, and you may say, oh, actually, are you straight, are you gay? What's not so easy to see is whether the guy who's wearing the pink cords had those cords tailored for him on Savile Row, or whether he picked them up from someone else. Do you know what I mean? Because his parents couldn't afford those cords. That's not that easy to see. And that's kind of quite a hidden kind of diversity, I think. Yeah. So that's something I really want to look more into, is how I can inspire people who, whilst they might think they look like me, actually came from a similar place that I came from, which was worrying. And don't get me wrong, I had a good upbringing. I was able to do the sports I wanted to do. We had holidays. But I didn't necessarily have the maybe financial leg up that some people would have. And I've worried about things like that, which maybe haven't taken up the brain space of some of my peers, for example. Again, it's not an issue necessarily, but it's just a consideration when you understand what your team makeup looks like and may actually look like. I definitely need to do some digging into my team and see what those kind of hidden diversities are, because they can bring a huge amount to you as a group.
People's determination to hide that suggests that there's a reason that they think they might be judged negatively about mm-hmm. it. That's certainly what I have seen in the yeah. army. Do you think that's the same in the Navy, or is it a bit more of a hit and miss?
So I do think it's different in the Navy. I think sounds a bit odd. I think we're a lot less tribal. So you guys obviously have your regiments. It is different. There's still, for me as an outsider, there's a, oh my goodness, you were infantry or you were guards. And that means one thing, or you wouldn't do that because you're not, because you're not of X, therefore you would never find yourself in that regiment, which probably is something you alluded to earlier. So I don't think in the Navy that is as much of an issue. However, it's still there. I think just being an officer full stop, it's there to a degree. I'm not sure what the late entry commissioning process is like in the army, but what I love about the Navy is we have great strength in our numbers of late entry commission personnel. So what they call upper yardsmen or senior upper yardsmen, depending on their age and experience or rank. You can take people that went through rally 2 years ago, but actually are deemed to be of officer material, not based on what they wear, funnily enough. That's not in the specialised report. It's about who they are as a person and the character traits that they display. And I think that's really good. And that's some of that hidden diversity. However, I think we can do better. You know, I still see people join ships with women wearing chinos. It's not a problem. I appreciate there are lots of women that want to wear chinos, but really, is that what you want to wear? Like, before you went to Dartmouth, did you really own those beige chinos? Did you wear them? And did you really own that pair of, like, those pair of brogues? Did you actually walk around in those every day? If not, what did you wear? And think about it. Is that offending anyone by wearing that in the officer's mess or the wardroom? I don't think it really is. Being able to be yourself, being authentic, and that increasing the output of your unit by you being there and being able to be yourself, which I think is super important. And sometimes you can't always see what that looks like. Sometimes you can wear the shoes you want to wear or have your hair or a little bit of makeup on. That might be really important to that person, and it genuinely might make them show up better at work.
Tony, you talked about how good the Navy is at recognising people with talent. So when they're going through training at rally, that they recognise that they have talent to become officers. You talked about the education that you had that afforded you these great opportunities. Do you think that there's more that could be done to help identify those people that have talent but perhaps didn't have the same education opportunities?
I think so, yeah. I don't think it's a secret that the military, not just our military, the US, for example, are going through similar challenges of recruiting is there. There is a difficulty there. At the very top is maybe people that have been to state boarding school still and have had that university education. And then there will be people in that gap that have not had an education. They might have left school really young because of X or Y circumstances. The Navy can still provide them with an education, provide them with a good job. And again, I speak from maybe not the most privileged position, but I've still got a university degree. The Navy paid for it for me. I definitely think we can do a better job, and not just the Navy, the military as a whole, of selling this package. There's an element of being made in the Royal Navy. That slogan's a good one, right? What can you fix? You can fix a skateboard, you can fix a Type 45 destroyer. That's definitely there. But I think there's probably work where all of us can do in focusing how we can mentor and talk to people and go and sell the good sell about life and the benefits of being in the military, and not just how you can be made in the Royal Navy, but how you can make the Royal Navy. So how you as an individual from a minority background, for example, or perhaps with a different education or no education, but fantastic vocational skills, can bring a huge benefit to the service and in turn your country. How we sell that, I think, is part of the challenge, right, from a communications and maybe even going down the media route as well, and how we sell ourselves and can help people from across the country. You don't need to do 35 years. You don't need to do 22 years. You can just do a couple of years. We have the power to make people's careers, make their lives in many, you know, I'm sure you can speak from experience, having travelled all over the world, you can make those possibilities a reality. I'm very fortunate because I had a member of my family who had been in the Navy, so they knew exactly what it was like. I'd say majority of the country doesn't, right? So I think that's really important, is getting the word out there, irrespective of service, to places we wouldn't normally go. Or, you know, for the Navy, to really small schools inland, for example, and state schools, right? In the same way that the Navy are really keen to tap into 50% of the population that are women, when we've only got about 13% in the service. So I think same rules apply, really.
And then once you've talked about people being recruited, the next stage is the learning whilst you're in service, because whilst there may be a policy book that explains what you're supposed to do, it's the relationships that you have with other people that will help unlock what the opportunities are. Yeah. And those unwritten experiences will make a massive difference about whether someone stays for 3 years or 5 years or longer. Yeah. How would you recommend people do that who are serving but are thinking about leaving? What would you recommend they do to look at extending their service and how?
So make the biggest network. There's that old saying of your network's your net worth. If you're leaving, 100% is, but I'm not leaving. And I've still every day make a conscious effort to improve my network, not just because it's great knowing loads of people and always having someone to call up when you need to go out for dinner or fancy a drink, but you get to learn from every single one of those people, whether they're Army, Navy, RAF, or civil servants. I'm conscious in my last job, although I had to interview for that job and I worked really hard to get it, I was very privileged because I got to meet all of these weird and wonderful people from all aspects of defence and defence industry as well. So for me, really work on your network. Having the access to opportunities often comes through having a big network, and that then may change your mind. I think a lot of people as well aren't as confident as I am in giving a plan to the career manager. So when you join, you probably join the careers office thinking, I want to be an air engineering officer on the back of a destroyer, or maybe not a destroyer, on an aircraft carrier with a group of Merlins, right? That looks what you think an air engineering officer is, and maybe doing ski champs every year because it's cool. You don't think past that, I don't think. You don't think, I want to one day end up as a captain when I leave the Navy, working in recruitment or helping our people strategy. You start to think like that. I think if you start to think like that early, try and help your career manager. Your career manager has like all the other people in your branch to manage. So if you can try and come up with a plan, get your front page to reflect the plan. We don't really ever get taught about our front pages when it comes to reports. And you kind of have to feel the way, but talk to other lieutenants or other captains or other majors or lieutenant commanders who've been there. They've worked hard on their front page. They've been lucky and had good mentors or, you know, a boss that can support them. Tell the career manager what you want and try and have that confidence. Obviously, you wouldn't recommend walking into your career manager's office and, you know, nailing a piece of paper to their desk, but genuinely put some thought behind what skills you can bring. Because I think in the military, because we don't have as many people as we should have because of the various gaps, we're not able to put necessarily always put the right people in the right jobs, right, based on talent and skills, because people have families, people have huge amounts of time they've been away, so they need to do some short time. But if you can genuinely prove why you should be in that role, and I've definitely done that for my only four jobs that I've had, I've written letters to people saying why I want to be there, I've had those conversations early to understand if that job's right for me, do it. Just go and do it. The amount of times I hear people say, I can't do that. I can't speak to my career manager. They're going to give me whatever job they give me. But actually, how hard have you tried to get the job? And also, how hard have you tried to know what jobs are out there? Looking on the jobs list is only going to give you so much. We know just how great our IT systems are, right, or aren't. So have a talk to people. The more you can increase your network, whilst also trying to work out what skills you've got and where they'd be best placed, I think will help you to increase your sense of purpose, and therefore probably keep you in the Navy or the military a little bit longer, because I think a lot of people leave because they don't feel like they belong or they've got that sense of purpose. But I think increase your chances of having a sense of purpose and doing meaningful work, and I think you'll probably want to stay a little bit longer because I think the rest of the package is pretty good.
Now, what comes next for you?
I don't know. I'm just going to go where the tide takes me. I'm super excited. I'm very energetic. I've got a year on HMS Prince of Wales, which again is a bit of a dream to get two aircraft carriers so early in my career. I just want to keep meeting new people. And the benefit of living in a small city, a floating city, is that you get to meet all these wonderful people. So as long as I can keep meeting people, spreading the love, whether that's about rugby or whether that's just about culture and chats like this, I'm pretty happy, to be honest with you. And the odd weekend away here and there.
Tony is a force of nature, but she recognises the importance of taking time to recharge. I loved how she said that you can't be what you can't see. I know this is true, but my sense is once you hear Tony, she will be hard to forget. Often the moral courage to speak up comes from unexpected quarters. It is brave to do this, especially when you are from the out culture. Her drive is building teams and improving performance. She gives a brilliant example of how you can change culture with just one action. We'd love to hear your thoughts at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Take care until next time.